So starting, I thought this might be a tricky riddle, but then I told my wife and she got it in like a second. So it's really maybe just a simple question. How do you know that the sun is still shining after it's gone down? The moon. Yeah. So it wasn't that tricky at all. So the moon, right? That when the sun sets, it goes to the other side of the world. Then you've got the moon reflecting the light of the sun. That's how we know it's still burning. At every point of every day, the sun is shining, right? It's burning up one side of the earth with its life-giving rays and its warmth. But the other side is kind of cloaked in darkness. And the only way that you know that the sun is still burning is because it's going up and reflecting off the moon. And they say that only like 3 to 12% of that light that hits the moon comes back down. That's why it's not warm, but it's bright enough, and it reminds us that there's a persistent presence that is the brightness and burning of the sun that keeps burning. And it reminds us that even though it's far away and that's even out of sight, it is still burning. And as we start our series in Exodus, we're going to go through all of chapter 1 and most of chapter 2 today. And what we see right away is that this is a dark period in Israel's history. It is not a good time, but we see also that there is these bright spots, these moments in which it's clear that God's presence is still with them, that God is still very aware of what's going on with them. He's watching and he's at work in their lives, and that a dawn is coming, that a better time is coming. And so in the darkness of these situations, we see that something better is ahead. And we don't just look back at these stories so that we can look at characters that are so far removed culturally and chronologically and say, ah, that was nice for them that God did that. We do see lots of good things about how God interacted with them and how they acted that are exemplary. But more importantly, we see God. We see God who never changes. We see the way he worked and continues to work. And so here we see that God is well aware of what's going on in the lives of his people, and he's concerned with them. And we can trust, as we see him at work in the story of the Israelites in the book of Exodus, that he is also aware of watching and working in what's going on in our lives, even if it seems like he's at a distance. And so if you've got a Bible or a phone, you can turn with me to Exodus 1. It will also be up on the screen if you find that easier to follow along with. But as you get there, Exodus 1, just chapter 1, verse 1, starting right from the start, just by way of a bit of background, Moses is the guy who wrote this, you know, the Red Sea guy. Moses wrote it probably around 1446 BC, some contention about the dates a little bit forward and back, but that's the time frame that's most commonly accepted for this one. And Exodus, it's an exit, it's a departure. And what we see is the Israelites going from slavery in Egypt, being set free from that. And what we see is kind of an end to a period of oppression of the descendants of Abraham. And we see the movement of God in beginning the fulfillment of his covenant promises that he made to make Israel a great nation. And so Exodus is the second book in the Bible if you're looking for it. It comes after Genesis. So we have that beginning. God created everything. Mankind fell into sin. God made promises with his people for abundance, for prosperity, for fruitfulness, for land, for protection, all these things. And then people continue to sin, and we see their sin and God's faithfulness and their repentance and God's faithfulness. And we see it unfold, and it ends Genesis with the story of Joseph. And then we kick this one off hearing his name again in chapter 1, verse 1. It says, these are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family. So Reuben and Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. And Joseph was another one of his sons. He was already in Egypt, right? And so Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation then died. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful, and they multiplied greatly, and they increased in numbers and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. So now they're down in Egypt. They used to live up north. Now they've gone down to Egypt. And when this talks about them being exceedingly numerous, like highly fruitful, we're talking like crazy. We're talking about them pushing maybe 1.5 million or 2 million people. And when we get to numbers, we see a chronological order that reveals to us that the time from when this list of people went down to Egypt, that was about 70, to now these people being, brought about ready for the Exodus, that time period is like 100 years. And so we see a couple of dozen people turn into 1.5 million, maybe 2 million people in 100 years. I don't know exactly how that works, but I'm assuming that there was babies every moment. There could be babies and triplets and quadruplets and octuplets. And it was a miracle of God, and people saw it as such because children were understood to be a blessing from God. And so although they're displaced, they're in Egypt, they're provided for, families are big, they're healthy, they see that God is with them. But then in verse 8, things take a turn. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, comes into power in Egypt. And this is where it's important that we know a little bit of Joseph's story. Joseph was a man who was living with his brothers and his family, and his brothers were jealous of him, so they sold him to slave traders who then took him down to Egypt. And they wanted to just get rid of him. They didn't want him in the family anymore, and he was kind of like the favorite of the family, and so they just decided to get rid of him by selling him into slavery. He went down to Egypt, and because of God's hand at work in his life, although he entered the nation of Egypt as a slave, he rose and rose and rose in prominence until he had a high ranking in the Egyptian government, was given great responsibility. He had wisdom from God. He was able to interpret dreams. He was given this ability from God to be so useful to the Egyptian government that he was brought into the nation as a slave. But by the end of his life, he was this dignified leader among the Egyptian people. And so with that came whatever treaty or agreement would have been there, that he could have all these brothers of his brought down and cared for and provided for out of the abundance of the Egyptian wealth. And so this family is there and everything's good, but then this new king takes over. And that's why this is so significant. Some suggest maybe the old king, not for sure who he was, maybe the one who brought Joseph up in the ranks was a foreign king who had conquered Egypt. Maybe that's why he wasn't so concerned about it being Egyptians only in power. But sure, bring in an Israelite, he's useful. We don't know for sure, but we might be led to think that perhaps this new king that came up was an Egyptian, through and through, was a nationalist who had pride and wanted to revitalize the national pride. Whatever the case would be, this new king came in, and whatever treaties and agreements that Joseph and his extended family had with the government meant bupkis to this guy. And so this guy then turns on them, and in verse 9 it says, he says, look to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they'll become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. And so they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses, the store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. And so the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites, and they worked them ruthlessly. And they made their lives bitter with harsh labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. And in all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. So things were pretty good for Israel. Yeah, they were down in Egypt, but that's where there was abundance, and so things were fine. And then all of a sudden, hundreds of thousands of them are brought into slavery because the new king feels threatened by their exceeding population in the midst of the Egyptian, boundaries. And so we find this first dark night with just a slight glimmer of the moon. I mean, this slavery is not, kind of get up a little bit early before the sun and work pretty hard all day and then go home and everything's fine. Like, this is inhumane, violently motivated, unrealistic deadlines. This is harsh, harsh slavery. It was an awful time. And for the people who were working, and when we try and put ourselves in their shoes, whose hands were blistered and bleeding, whose skin was cracking from the hot sun, who were being violently beat as motivation, it must have, to them, seemed like God was very, very far away. But yet when they got home, what did they arrive home to? Babies. Babies, 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 babies. For some reason, God wanted to link their oppression to their fertility. And the more they were oppressed, the more fertile they were. And the king had this idea that we, with harsh labor and slavery, can corral the explosive growth of this population. And God decided, no. The harder they work in the day, the more successful they'll be in their practices at night. And the baby-making process was just on par. They were making it happen. And the king was upset by this. The king was bothered by this. And so, pain, slavery, that didn't work. So what's he going to do? Well, in verse 15, he comes up with a new plan. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, not that these were the only two for like a couple million people, but they likely oversaw the midwives. He gave them the command in verse 16, When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that baby is a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. If you can imagine being 7, 8 months pregnant, excited, and you hear news that this is the command of the king, man, there's no going for an ultrasound to check if it's a boy or a girl, so you can kind of mentally prepare yourself. All you do is wait, and you know that the woman who is coming to draw near to you in this, you know, no pain medication, maybe a stick in your teeth, I don't know what they had, but no pain medication, no epidurals. This woman who was to coach you through that had been given the order, if it comes out a boy, kill it on the spot. Can you imagine the anxiety for mothers in that moment? The weeping, the wailing, the pleading with the midwives that, it's hard to even imagine. And knowing that the midwives, this isn't really like a thing to take lightly. If they don't follow the king's edict, then it's probably their neck on the line for not complying with it. And so this was an awful, awful time, an incredibly dark moment. But what are we told is that the midwives actually feared God more than they feared the king. They feared the invisible God more than they feared the flesh and blood man who could have their head on a platter like that if he just said the word. And God, in his graciousness, maintained the faith of the Hebrew midwives in spite of the horrendous circumstances for the nation, to the point that hearkened them to act in ways that showed fear of God above all else. As a person, I know what it's like. I want to keep peace with people. I want to make people happy. I don't want to rock the boat. And the idea of working entirely opposite and kind of separate from that is amazing. This, to me, is a shining example of not being concerned with what the people around you are going to think or what the consequences are going to be. These midwives show us in by faith that they're concerned first with what is right in God's eyes, and then second, with what's right in God's eyes, and then third, what's right in God's eyes, and then what people think and have told them to do. If it's in contrast to what God has called them to do, it's insignificant. It doesn't even end up in the equation. It's an incredibly inspirational thing. And they act out of this reverence for God and his ways. What might happen to them as a result is yet to be seen. And so what happened in verse 18 was that the king of Egypt summoned them. I'm assuming they're terrified in this moment. Summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" And the midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous, and they give birth before the midwives arrive." I think that's a compliment to Hebrews and a slam to Egyptians. I don't know what exactly that means, but I don't want to spend too much time being critical of these inspirational, faithful women, but this isn't a shining moment, right? Like, they had acted out of fear and respect and reverence for God, but in the moment, they're face-to-face with the king, and they waver. They don't tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. They say something that allows them to get let off a little bit easier, and we see here that although maybe their motives were pure, that their actions maybe not so much when they lied, and we see that the purity of motives doesn't actually transfer over and purify actions that are not right. And we see it a little bit later in Moses' life, but it's something to be mindful of. And yet we see God in response to that in verse 20. He was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives did fear God, he gave them families of their own. Not that God was rewarding them for their kind of little white lies, but he was being gracious to them because although they were fallible, somewhat sinful, doubting people at times, they were also people who loved and feared him and acted that way. And beyond that, he was continuing to fulfill his promise that Israel would become a great nation. In all this, God is at work, even in these horrendously difficult times, and we see that at work. Perhaps it's not necessarily right out in front that we see God's mighty hand at work, but it's certainly there as the story's unfolding. We see that he is watching, he's very aware of what's going on, and he's working towards his own end. God, in his sovereignty, being in control of all things, providentially moves things towards his ends. And so whether people are honoring him, he's using that towards his own glory. Whether people are acting in horrendous and evil ways, he's able to providentially bring that about to his glory. But the king obviously isn't satisfied with what he sees happening here, so he kicks it up a notch. instead of saying to the midwives, you guys who are on the scene there first, kill the babies, he then puts out the edict to all the Egyptian people. If you see a Hebrew baby, every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. And so now the danger level goes through the roof. The people must be absolutely terrified, and we have in chapter 2, verse 1, this new start that a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him. She coated it with tar and pitch, and then she placed her child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. And his sister, that baby's sister, stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Now, if we look forward to Hebrews chapter 11, it recalls great acts of faith in the Old Testament. And one of those is that of this Moses' parents in hiding him. Putting him in the river wasn't such a great act of faith. They were acting out of disbelief that God would continue to protect and provide for their child. But the faith that they had to keep this baby for months on end, raising him until eventually they got to this point where it's almost ironic because Moses' mother did in a token way, obey the king's edict to throw the baby in the river, except she made him a tiny little boat first and put him in it and put him among the reeds. And then we see in verse 5 what happens next. And Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank, and she saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her female slave to get it. And this is a moment where I think we see things go from bad to worse, right? I mean, all the people are commanded to execute Hebrew baby boys on the spot. Most certainly, there was weeping and great wailing all around the nation as this was happening, as people who saw their children torn from their hands to be thrown into the river to drown or be eaten by crocodiles. It was a horrendous scene. And now this child who was born to parents of great faith, who saw this child as a gift of God, who saw great potential in him and protected him, eventually saw no longer a way to preserve his life, so they set him out on the water with a hope and a prayer. And the one who discovers this child is none other than the daughter of the one who issued the command to have this kid killed. And I mean, would a member of Pharaoh's family not be the person you'd least want to find your baby if it was you in that situation? We think we know what she would do, but verse 6 tells us otherwise. She opened the basket, she saw the baby, he was crying, and she felt sorry for him. And this is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Like, wow, this. She felt sorry for him. She knew exactly who he was and what she was supposed to do with him. It wasn't like she was going to have to take him on a long car ride and listen to him wailing and have to endure it. She's on the riverbank. She sees the baby. She knows exactly what she's supposed to do with it, but she feels sorry for him. And there's nothing magnificent or noble about feeling sorry for an abandoned baby who's been placed in the river waiting to die of exposure or just be eaten by animals. I mean, if that doesn't tug at heartstrings, you need your pulse checked. There's nothing magnificent or noble about that, but this national pride was a powerful force. To not obey the Pharaoh and his commands was not an optional thing. The ability to choose what was opposite and act in just direct defiance of the Pharaoh, that wasn't an insignificant thing. And for her as a member of his own household to rebel against that could have grave consequences for her. But this woman who was moved by compassion and moved by her God-given maternal instinct falls in love with this baby on the spot. And it goes on in verse 7, then his sister, which is Moses' sister, a girl named Miriam, here maybe she's 10 or 12 years old. Kids at 10 or 12 years old don't have a ton of wherewithal and maybe great insight into situations around them, but this kid must have had the Lord with her, because then the sister pops out from, you know, the reeds in the riverbank when she sees this unfold. She'd been watching to see what would happen to her brother, and as soon as she comes out, she says, oh, should I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse that baby for you? I mean, how courageous of her to step out and to speak those words. And Pharaoh's daughter said, yes, go. So the girl went and got the baby's mother, Moses' mom. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby, nurse him for me, and I'll pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. And when the child grew older, probably by the time he was weaned, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. The meaning of Moses. So in this, we see Moses' own mother, get paid to breastfeed him. Like, it's a work of God in these circumstances that this is how it came to be. If we ever doubt that God is in control, we look here. If we ever doubt that God can use people's evil deeds towards an eventual good, we look here. If we wonder if God has a sense of humor, we look at the irony of this situation. That Moses, this baby who had been the people had been commanded to ruthlessly execute, ends up being a part of that same Pharaoh's royal household. And while he was young, his mother got paid to raise him. I mean, it's an incredible way that God is at work. And if you know the story, you know Moses is a big character. He becomes the deliverer of God's people. But before he's able to deliver others, God is delivering him and showing who the true deliverer is. He's preserving his life, and he's doing that in the midst of this most awful time in the history of Israel. I don't know if you see what I'm seeing, but in the darkness of the night, it's not that God is absent. He's watching and he's working. And in the same way the moon reflects the presence of the sun, we see these moments in our lives and in this story that reflect his presence and his love, even when he seems far away. And then Moses, many years later, grows up, and we pick it up in verse 11 there. One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were, and he watched them at their hard labor, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. And so, great, we're going to get a glimpse into the kind of character Moses has. How does he deal with conflict? What has God raised him up to be able to do amongst people? And we note in that verse, it says he went out to where his own people were. He watched them beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. He was well aware of his heritage. He didn't think he was an Egyptian. In fact, over and again, as I said, Hebrews 11, we hear about Moses, and it says that by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, he refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He instead chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He identified deeply with the violent oppression that his countrymen were under, and so he comes across this scene, and what does he do? How's he going to fix it? Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. This is a man preserved, you know, by God from birth. God had great things in mind for him. How does he just murder somebody? Like, yeah, his motive was right. He wanted to stop the violence and the oppression. But like we saw with the midwives, having a right motive doesn't mean that your actions are right. His actions are all wrong. And this is something we should always remember. When we have God-given passions, that we value the things that God values and we go after them, having those good motives doesn't always lead to God-honoring actions. We always have to submit our thoughts, our actions, the outworking of the values that God has given us to still being within his ways, within what is right. A cop doesn't plant drugs to ensure that the drug dealer gets busted. A good cop works within the confines of the law. He pursues what is right by doing what is within the realm of what is right. And we ought to do the same thing. And we look at Moses and think, come on, he grew up with privilege, with education. He knew exactly what would have happened to somebody who was guilty of a crime like this. And he spent his whole life, from the very moments in which God protected him in the most dangerous situations of his life, as a baby sitting on the river as crocodile bait, he's growing up to be a somebody. And then this dark stain on his life drives him towards decades of obscurity out in the desert as he runs away and spends decades becoming a nobody. And the next day, I mean, he looked from the right and to the left. He saw nobody, and then he hid the body, so he thought he was free and clear. But the next day, it says in verse 13, he went out and he saw two Hebrews fighting. He must have been so frustrated, right? Like, come on, brothers. The Egyptians are beating us enough. We don't need to beat each other as well. And so he comes up and he says to the one who was in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? And the man said, who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? Uh-oh. I think the guy that he saved squealed and told the story. And Moses was afraid and thought, what I did must have become known. And when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. And the story carries on from there. But he ran. I mean, what else could he do? He could stand and face the music, you know, man up, but he wouldn't be standing for long. He would have been cut down and killed immediately. And so this looks like it might be the last we see of Moses. Right? I mean, just another sad exclamation point at the end of this painful era in Israel's history. But it's not the end of Moses. We see next week that God remembers Moses. God hasn't forgotten his people. He hasn't forgotten about his plans for Moses, and he appears in a burning bush, and he calls him to the task for which he preserved his life, for which he was born, for which he would end up using those years of living and hiding in the desert to the advantage of God's people. And despite these dark, dark days, God is never ceasing to be acting on behalf of the people that he loves. And I think we might be inclined to think at times that it was because maybe the Israelites were really faithful, because we from our perspective, tie God's faithfulness to our good obedience and action and worship and assume that he will love us so long as we obey the way he wants us to. But we actually, though it doesn't show us in this passage, we find out that the people weren't all that faithful to God in this particular time. They were turning to the left, they were turning to the right towards idols of the people of Egypt, and we don't see it here, but God wasn't working towards their deliverance because they were being so faithful to him. We see in later books what they were really like. We see in the book of Joshua that God commanded the people to throw away the gods of their ancestors that were worshipped beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt, and called them back to serving the Lord. They had gods that they carried with them for a long, long time after their time in Egypt. The prophet Ezekiel speaks back to the time when they were in Egypt and says, I was going to bring them out of Egypt. And then verse 7 says, he says to the people, get rid of the vile images you've set your eyes on. Don't defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. He hearkens back to this time when the people weren't being particularly faithful, but God was being faithful. Because God had made them these promises to give them abundance, to give them a future, to give them fruitfulness and land and protection. He had made a covenant with Abraham that would extend to his children, Isaac and Jacob, and then would extend to their children and all those who were in bondage and slavery in Egypt. And God makes good on what he promises. When we look just towards the end of this chapter, verse 23, we see a little bit more about this God of ours, that during that long period, the king of Egypt died. And the Israelites groaned in their slavery. They cried out, and their cry for help because of slavery went up to God. And God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And so God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. And that's a phrase that ought to give us great hope, that while these people were inclined to worship idols, when they turned to God, when they cried out to them, he hadn't closed his ears to them. He heard them. He remembered his promises to them, and he acted in accordance with that, having compassion on them. And so we look at the lives of these people from millenniums ago, and it's not only because of how they acted and how we can imitate how they acted that this story is valuable. Absolutely, we can see stuff that shapes our lives, shapes our faith. We look at Moses and say, wow, he murdered somebody and yet was used by God for great things. And so we can look at our own lives then and say, well, perhaps the thing that I feel disqualifies me from being used by God, well, it's probably less of a big deal than that. And it's not that he doesn't want to help us change and move on from those things and by his grace help us to become different. But man, if our holy God, if our God is not using our sin as an excuse to not have a purpose for us, then we really should get off our cans and not use our sin as an excuse to not be used by him and to avail ourselves to that. I mean, if he is not holding our sin against us and making us purposeless because of that, why would we act purposeless because of our sin, assuming that he has no role for us in his kingdom? The saints we see are fallible people, sinful people. We're not given a purpose through Christ because we're without sin. We're given purpose and called to his mission despite our sin, and so we press on in that. We embrace that forgiveness is available, and we just move forward in the midst of what God has called us to. And we see, aside from the fallibility of people, we see the great faith. And we're inspired by it. The parents of Moses showed great faith in hiding him. They spared his life. The faith of the midwives, instead of fearing the Pharaoh, was incredibly inspiring. We see how a fear for God should supersede the fear of man. This is good exemplary stuff. But beyond that, we see God. We see how he's constantly at work. And that's what's so beautiful about this story. He's providentially using moments in which people are choosing to honor him and exercise faith in him, and he's using that to bring about the promises that he had made to the people. And then when men like Pharaoh intend nothing but evil and death and pain for the people that God so desperately loves, God uses that towards his own ends of fulfilling the promises that he has made to his people. That's how God works in every single part of your life and what's happening around our lives, every detail and failure and victory and success. It's all used providentially by our sovereign God to further his purposes. That's how he used to work in the days of the Exodus, and our God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, and so that's exactly how he works today. And he calls us to faith in that. And when I look at a story like that, yeah, they have this moon to look to, these moments of brightness that remind them that though the sun is a long way away, that God is a long way away, it would seem, they see him at work, but he calls us to faith in his being good despite what we see. I mean, it's not just faith in what we see that we're called to. I mean, is that not faith, to believe in that which we don't see? I wanted to talk and kind of guide us to a place where it's kind of a pick-me-up and say, you know what, just look for the bright spots. Look for the moon that reminds you of the sun, because there's silver lining in just about everything. I posted this morning, I mean, the Canucks lost the draft horribly. We can't even win a lottery, for crying out loud. But the silver lining is that Edmonton didn't win it, so that's good. But in this story, I don't want us to just look for a silver lining in difficult circumstances, but instead call us to faith when we see nothing of the goodness of God, trusting that he is watching and that he is working, because that's who he is. It reminds me of when the resurrected Jesus shows up to his disciples and poor Thomas isn't there. And they see him and they're excited, and Thomas comes back from wherever he was and hey guys, how's it going? It's going well. We saw Jesus. What? He showed up when I wasn't here? I don't believe you. I won't believe you unless I can put my hand in the nail holes in, or my fingers in the nail holes in his hands. And so, oh man, well, that's a bummer for him. Everybody's pumped and talking about it. And he's just, no, I'm not going to believe until I see him. And then a week later, Jesus shows up and says, hey, you want to put your fingers in the nail holes in my hands? Go for it. And Thomas is amazed and believes. And Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And this is the faith that we're called to. Life happens in seasons. Sometimes we bask in the presence of God, and it's as obvious as and undeniable as when we sit under the sun. We're blinded by its light. We bask in its warmth. We leave with a burn as proof that us and the sun were tight for a while. Sometimes it's as obvious as that. Other times the sun is shining. God is still there, but it's on the other side of the world. And all we've got is the memory of the last time the sun was shining and the promise that it's going to shine again to get us through the dark time. And yes, we've got moments of brightness that we can find in the midst of it, a small bit of light that give us hope. But we can remember in the midst of it that God is not abandoned shining in his glory. He's not forgotten his promises. He's not failed to be who he always is. And for all that God has done in the daylight, for the cross of Jesus Christ, for the power of the presence of the Spirit in the moment in which he called you to faith for the first time, for those moments in which the presence of God is so powerful, it's as undeniable as it is to sit in the sun and to feel its warmth. For those moments, he is surely worthy of faith in times of darkness. He is surely worthy of worship in times where it is not so easy to see him. And we can have hope not only because we see silver linings to cling to, although he is gracious and gives us those constantly, but we can be darn sure that God has not turned a blind eye to us, that he is at work, that he is bringing his promises to bear in our lives. We can rest in that because that's who he is. And it's apart from who we are and what we've done. He is permanently glorious. He is permanently truthful. He is permanently faithful and strong. The God of the Exodus is the exact same God that we worship and serve today. And so I want to ask you to stand as we pray, and we're gonna continue to worship him. God, you are worthy of all worship, of all praise, of all adoration. You are worthy of our time, of our money, of our physical selves. You are worth beyond the greatest capacities of what we could offer you. There is no denying that. And yet, in moments of darkness, we struggle to offer ourselves wholly unto you at times. And yet we see in a story like this that you are constantly good. And while you give us hope, you give us the ability to see your mighty hand at work, even in terrible and tragic circumstances. We praise you and thank you for those. I pray you would build in us a faith that is not dependent on what we see, though, not dependent on our circumstances, a faith that is entirely apart from that, a conviction that you are who you say you are, that you always have been, and that you always will be, a truthful and strong and glorious God. And God, as you preserved Moses' life, I pray that you would use similar power to preserve and build our faith, that you, in times of darkness and trial, would build in us the and protect in us the great deposit that is the Holy Spirit's presence in us. May we walk in ways that glorify you in all things. And God, as people here may be struggling with a time that resonates like that of the Exodus, where it just seems like oppression abounds, and it is so difficult to see you near, I pray that by the grace of your Spirit, we would know you to be near, whether our circumstances change and reflect that or not. Help us to desire to be a part of what you're doing and your glory in all the world, as opposed to our own. We are yours, and we worship you.